Welcome to Vote Why, though, a roundtable conversation about all things pop culture. I'm your host, Alex, and I am joined this week by Swara.
Thanks so much for having me again, Alex. I'm happy to be here.
Happy to have you here. It's less of a roundtable, more of just a two-person conversation, but I'm definitely looking forward to it. This week, we are doing more of a thought experiment and less of a traditional episode, specifically just what would like games and media look like without capitalism? And this was an idea that you had pitched, and I just wanted to hear more about kind of where your inspiration for it came from.
Really, it was from virtually every conversation we've been having on the podcast or that I've been listening to, where we almost always end the topic with capitalism is the villain. Capitalism is what's ruining everything, ruining everything we love. So what if we just talked about all the films, TV, games, books, etc., in a setting without capitalism driving things? So why don't we just discuss what that would look like?
Yeah, I'm into it. I'm looking forward to that. Before we get into that, though, what have you been enjoying this week?
Oh, I have been enjoying so many things. First off, number one, you can read my review on But Why, though. Sinners. This is Ryan Coogler's magnum opus, at least his magnum opus to date. You may have heard about it from other folks, and just go to the theater and watch it. Try to go in as blind as you can. This is such a magnificent horror film that just encapsulates so much about Black history in the Jim Crow South, and with all its various themes about Black art and Black ownership. And just Ryan Coogler is a genius. As the writer director of this amazing film, this is honestly one of my favorite films of all time. It is a masterpiece. It's so good. Other than that, I've been enjoying two animated series a lot, both of which are on Max. So, by the way, everything I'm talking about is like Warner Brothers Discovery stuff. So, you know, just proves, despite its executives' many faults, I am a lifelong Warner Brothers fanboy. First off is this amazing new animated series called Iyanu, which is based on the graphic novel of the same name, Iyanu, Child of Wonder. And this is about a girl who is the quote-unquote chosen, endowed with magical powers meant to save the world. And it definitely has some Avatar The Last Airbender vibes, but it is certainly its own thing. And It's so rich with Nigerian culture. Like, the place that it takes place in is literally called Yoruba land. Yoruba is a language they speak in Nigeria. And yeah, watch it on Max. I really hope that it gets a second season if enough people watch it and hype it up. And, you know, the other series I've been really enjoying, it came out last month, actually, something else I really want to get renewed, something quite different, but Tiny Toons Looniversity. I'm a lifelong Looney Tunes fan. I am a lifelong Tiny Toons fan. And this one honors the spirit of the original so well. And Montana Max is a perfect capitalist villain. So that's all I've been enjoying.
I've heard, so going back to the start, I've heard nothing but good things about Sinners, and I'm very excited to see it. Mm-hmm. Tiny Toons is a property that to me was really iconic growing up, and then I just like never hear anyone talking about it. So I will have to check that series out. Like, I had the like Happy Meal toys of it, like ever. Like, I loved that show.
Yeah.
So hearing that they're bringing it back, I know that they had brought it back
two seasons so far. And yeah, we gotta like, you know, get people to keep watching it. You know, in the capitalist system we're in, we don't know if it'll get a third season, but it thoroughly deserves it. So as many people have to watch it as possible. It's so good. Tiny Toons Looniversity on Max. Please watch it.
Definitely. I will check that out. My thing that I've been enjoying this week, because I'm not going to let myself talk about Blueprints for a third week in a row, is it's a YouTube channel, but also an event called Choir, Choir, Choir. Have you heard of this?
I've not, actually.
So it's basically it is a drop-in sing-along. It's a concert is kind of how it's like presented. There's like people on stage, but then they like give out sheet music to everyone. They have arrangements of like pop songs, and they just get everyone to sing the song. So it's like, here's you and 1500 other people belting out, you know, these songs that you came here to see, whether it's like a theme night or a specific band. The way that I found out about this was when I was going down the rabbit hole of the Tragically Hip, one of Canada's most Canadian bands. They, a year after the lead singer died, they did a choir, choir, choir concert where they sang one of his songs. And this is, I'm not going to say that like these shows are, you know, like mind-blowing art or anything like that, but I think there's something really really refreshing about just seeing people come together and enjoy art and participate in it. And seeing, you know, like the Tragically Hip concert specifically, seeing so many people turn out for somebody whose art meant something to them and wanting to kind of like, you know, let that art outlive its creator. So yeah, choir, they're on YouTube. They have like, I think 300,000 subscribers. It's like, which by YouTube numbers is not huge. Like it's a good size, but like when people have like tens of millions, you know, but yeah, it's been really cool. I went through and they, you know, some of them are much more straightforward. Other of them are, you know, like full on arrangements where you're adding in stuff that wasn't quite there. They have a conductor who's kind of on stage, giving actual cues so that people know like when to hold notes, when to cut notes, all that stuff. And yeah, it was just really cool to see and to discover. And there's so much there to watch. I highly recommend it. But yeah, I think that's what I've got for this week. Now, before we get too deep into things, Swara, where can people find you online?
Y'all can find me on Blue Sky at Spider Swars. You can find me on Instagram also at Spider Swars. And I'm a writer for various outlets, including But Why Though, The Nerds of Color, The New Arab, other websites. And I co-host the podcast, The Middle Geeks, where we're two fans of West Asian descent discussing everything in Southwest Asian, North African media.
Nice. And you can find me online at Most Always Alex. I'm on Blue Sky, and that is basically it. Technically, I still have a presence on Twitter in that I have an account, but I do not use it. So come find me on Blue Sky. Would love to hear from you. And now, let's do this thought experiment.
Let's do it.
So I guess the first thing I want to establish, and this isn't in the show notes, though, is like, how do we currently fund things? It's giant companies. It's also smaller companies. There are people who personally finance passion projects, which is more in line with what we're doing. And I think part of what made this episode pitch so interesting to me is as soon as you try to engage with it, you kind of realize how wrapped up money is in all of this. You know, you need to pay for studio time to record an album. You need to buy the instruments, the effects, the amps, whatever. You need to pay for mixing and mastering. You need to pay for an editor for your movie. You need to pay for a cinematographer, actors, craft service. Like so much of this just costs money, or you have to get people to really, like, especially with something like craft services, be like, hey guys, we can't feed you. Like, we just need you to show up and like, and do it. And the way that that gets paid for, like I said, is like studios. Like, people will find investors, people will find producers who are like, I'll give you the money if I get to be a producer, which we'll get into that of kind of like, well, why does it matter that money is involved? am I missing any parts of the picture of just like, this is how stuff gets paid for?
Well, I suppose, you know, we'll get into it in the actual discussion. Yes, it is. Generally, as you know, we understand it, how like film and TV we love gets paid for, but there are many, in fact, public fundings and public ownership of film and TV that are really deeply embedded in, you know, and we're talking primarily about Western society, but specifically English speaking countries and the US and UK specifically. And I would argue, I would think, just general knowledge is that the UK has more, but even so, the US has a lot in the last several or so decades that is so embedded for the general audience.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think what was interesting to me is as I went down this rabbit hole of like, well, what are we currently publicly funding? It's a lot of stuff that people know and love.
Yeah.
And they just might not know that it's publicly funded. Or publicly owned in some instances too. So yeah, like if we're going to look at public funding, there's, you know, PBS is like the prime example in the US, which not all of their money comes from it comes from donors. It comes from the government. They, you know, have very specific rules around what advertising they can run, that kind of stuff. And PBS gave us Mr. Rogers and Arthur and Sesame Street and documentaries, and they broadcast like local high school sports, things that aren't going to get picked up elsewhere.
Also, if I can just jump in.
It's a cool service.
Yeah, also if I could just jump in, like, they also have musicals. You know, I often joke about it, you know, the horrible movie in 2019, but growing up, I actually did watch the 1998 recording of Cats the Musical. I would watch it on PBS all the time. I've loved musical theater all my life, and part of it is because, yeah, Cats has music that slaps. And even though it is a very weird story, I learned that through PBS. PBS also has a good amount of British series that were brought to the US, like via PBS. I think there's this one murder mystery series. I forget exactly what it was called. I just remember it had this really cool cartoon opening. It has Keeping Up Appearances, another classic British comedy. And of course, probably the most famous British show ever in the US, Downton Abbey, being a showcased on Masterpiece PBS. And that, like, just, and again, Downton Abbey is something that, like, so many people watch. And it's mm-hmm. via this publicly funded medium of PBS. So it really, again, is just so deeply embedded in our society.
It is. Yeah. I mean, and then, you know, going, like you said, like going to British media. Mm-hmm. Also, actually, sorry, before we move on from PBS, mm-hmm. there's also this weirdness with Sesame Street where it's produced and, you know, like all in-house PBS stuff. Online, though, its presence is largely HBO Max.
Right.
Is it exclusively, or is it also on YouTube?
So here's what happened. Sesame Street, I want to say about 6 or 7 years ago or so, made a deal with Warner Brothers Discovery or Max, HBO. Sorry, they made a deal specifically with HBO. Sorry, there are so many terms, mm-hmm. which is owned by Warner Brothers Discovery. And basically, HBO would have, in return for them, like, doing the funding of Sesame Street, which unfortunately was in need of more funding, you know, not just public funding, HBO would get first dibs on release to the public. That would incentivize mm-hmm. parents, you know, pay for an HBO subscription. And then later, Sesame Street would be on PBS as it usually is, and everyone was basically happy. Well, people were worried in the first place, as they were right to be, about this capitalist intervention into such a beloved public children's TV show. And then, as we know, Zaslav, CEO of Warner Brothers Discovery, came crashing in and decided that, hey, no, HBO is not going to, or Max now is not going to fund Sesame Street mm-hmm. anymore, this beloved children's staple TV. And now Sesame Street is in need of a studio home, which is terrible. Everyone is hoping someone picks up Sesame Street. But again, this is what happens when you have capitalist intervention. So it's really terrible, because, like, Sesame Workshop itself does so much good, not only in the US, but worldwide. There's a there's a specific program in the Arab world. I believe it's called Tafaddal Simsim, or it's like Simsim Street, something like that, because Simsim means mm-hmm. Sesame in Arabic. And they do such great work for refugee kids across the Swana region, across, like, places, across countries in the Arab world. And yeah, like, it has always been a public good. And then you had capitalism come and fuck around with Sesame yes. Street. So,
which yeah. that actually, I'm going to jump ahead in my own sure. mental notes, but something really interesting that I found while researching, just kind of like some very basic examples of publicly funded media, is how often there is an accusation or a lawsuit alleging a political, specifically left-leaning bias in what they show. And I'm like, interesting that the people who are interested in making publicly funded, freely available media would have a left-leaning bias, and now you're upset about it. And it's, yeah, I don't know. It just feels a little showing your hand, where it's yeah. like you're not involved, but then you're mad that they're doing it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's just that, you know, because for us leftists, it really is a lot of basic human kindness and wanting people of marginalized communities to be included, be on an equal level playing mm-hmm. field, as active and embraced members of society. Sesame Street was literally founded for Black and brown inner city kids. It literally helped them in education and helping them feel included and seen. Like, again, Sesame Street is just, it's so pure. It's huge. And I don't think it's a hyperbole to say that Sesame Street has saved lives. Like, absolutely has saved lives. And like, you know, we all learn from it growing up. You know, we count along with the count. We, you know, laugh at Bert and Ernie. Elmo teaches us about kindness and empathy even today.
Except Rocco. But no, I agree. I think Sesame Street has largely been a force for good. Mm-hmm. And again, publicly funded, but still like impacting all over the world. So then going over to like Great Britain, there's Channel 4 is a publicly owned channel. If you like Great British Bake Off, that's it. They also locally do like history, documentaries, school programming. As of 2020, they do Taskmaster. If you like Taskmaster, mm-hmm. again, this is all publicly owned, publicly funded. The BBC, like if you enjoy Top Gear or Doctor Who or the Planet Earth documentary series, like these are just kind of examples I wanted to rattle off for us of like public funding can do really cool and incredible things.
Yes.
And then on a smaller scale, we also just have like the idea of patronage mm-hmm. and commissions. You get, you know, like Kickstarter for like people who have like a new invention or media, like a comic book, a game, an album, a story, like just whatever it is that they want to get out there. We have Patreon for ongoing support and smaller. I mean, honestly, you could argue that OnlyFans is part of this, of like people like as patrons, but like there are opportunities online to support artists directly or to say, like, I know there's a YouTube art channel that I follow that on their Patreon, one of the tiers is a commission. Mm-hmm. If you paid X, and they're like, we understand that you might not want to do that ongoing. So if you want to bump up to that tier for 1 month, get your commission and go back down, we totally understand. And yeah, like there's cool ways to get and support art, and that's both privately and like as a person and publicly.
Yeah. To go back to the UK examples, I think another dichotomy to the US and UK, most of the public funding, at least for the most prominent shows that we know, and again, like on PBS, the more adult shows would be taken from the UK. But in the UK, you know, with Great British Bake Off, even though that's for all ages, but, you know, Top Gear, Doctor Who, which, you know, is like all ages, but also is like, you know, it's a huge popular franchise. And it's so richly embraced by, you know, millions and millions of fans worldwide. Mm-hmm. And that, like you said, is a publicly funded show. But then also on Channel 4, you have in the last few years, Nita Mansour's We Are Lady Parts, which is a show about, is like not for kids. It's like PG-13 at least, or even rated R sometimes. It's about this amazing all Muslim woman punk rock band in the UK, and you know, they're swearing, they're cursing, they're talking about sex, and it's so diverse and just amazing. Watch We Are Lady Parts on Peacock here in the US. I love this show so much. And again, that's still something that's like publicly owned and within like the realm of being publicly funded, as well as Doctor Who and Planet Earth. On Doctor Who, now, as we know, in the last few years since the previous season that started with Nishuti Gatwa, well, actually previously was David Tennant again, but now Doctor Who is a co-production with Disney, because previously the distributor for Doctor Who was HBO, like outside the UK, but then BBC struck up a deal with Disney to not only for Disney Plus to be the distributor of Doctor Who, but also for Disney to be its co-producer. So again,
also gross.
Yes. So again, we have an instance of capitalism, you know, infringing on a beloved series, like a beloved staple of TV. I will say, however, thankfully, that has not affected in any way that I can personally tell the quality of Doctor Who. You know, we have Russell T.
They're still steering it for the most part.
Yes. BBC is still like the primary creative force behind it. They still own Doctor Who. Disney is like just stepping in and being like, hey, let's help you a little bit. undoubtedly, you know, Disney execs have like machinations in their mind of like, ooh, here's how we can own Doctor Who in the future. I knock on wood, like hopefully that's not going to be the case, but there is always that risk, right? But still, thankfully, because it is still in this publicly funded hands of BBC and Russell T. Davies specifically, who I think is one of Doctor Who's best ever creators, and with Nishuti Gatwa is one of the best doctors in that I've seen. Like, he's my favorite since David Tennant, honestly. So thankfully it hasn't, you know, affected its quality too much, or it hasn't been wrestled from, like, you know, the public. Because here's the other thing: Doctor Who is such a beloved British staple, it would be inconceivable for it to really like be wrecked from the hands of BBC. I hope so.
there would be a similar backlash to that as there was to And this is pulling far back, but I feel like both with the casting of Captain America and Superman, and granted, Superman did go to a British person, but with the casting of both of those, there was a huge backlash when people suggested anyone other than an American. And I feel like changing the ownership of Doctor Who to anyone other than a British company would have a similar outcry.
Yeah. It's part of British DNA. Yeah. But sorry, all this to say is that, you know, all these publicly funded or publicly owned media in the UK are very adult. It shows that huge demonstration that publicly funded media can be diverse. It can be amazing quality. It can be very mature. It can be basically everything that audiences could want. It can be, it's not just like when people think of, like, especially in the US, when they think of like what publicly funded media is, they think specifically of PBS, because that's all they've been exposed to.
Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers, which is very telling.
Exactly. But it really can be anything. And that should expand our imaginations of what a publicly funded model for film and TV can be.
Yeah. And so, we've talked about what public funding can accomplish. So going to like the thought experiment of it, if that gets removed, if the capitalism part of it is gone and we're just to the public funding part, like, what do you see as being the potential outcomes for this? Just kind of in your own estimation. I think for me, the big one is, this is obviously like daydreaming, but I do think that we start getting things with less mass appeal. And I mean that in a complimentary way. I think as soon as making money is not the motivation of the person funding the art, what you can do with it changes inherently. I think that there's plenty of movies that I've seen where I'm like, here's a good example. Did you see Stranger Than Fiction?
Yes. Great film.
I think the good ending to Stranger Than Fiction is if he had died.
Okay.
Why
do you think that? I'm curious.
I mean, I haven't seen the movie in a long time, so I would have a hard time fully defending it. But I feel like the way that it was going, having him not die kind of undercut some of the themes of the film. But it was a thing of like, I wonder if that was added of like, oh, audiences don't like that we killed him, so like, here's like the alternate ending where we didn't kill him, to people like that. And I think you just start getting people making more choices based on what they want to do with the art, what they want to say with the art, and less concern over, is this going to sell tons of tickets? I mean, obviously, artists want their work to be seen. I don't want to say, you know, that they don't. But I think that there are just times where it's like, oh, like, I really wanted to do this, but I pulled back because I didn't think people would like it. And it's like, oh, so this song isn't what you wanted it to be, or this movie isn't what you wanted it to be, because you were concerned with what other people would think of it.
You see, what we're getting into now is really the paradox of what people claim about capitalism, especially capitalism in the arts, that, oh, this will allow for people to be creative, do whatever they want. But as we know, capitalism often entails these very greedy executives who want to flatline everything they touch. And you know what I think the worst example of this is? Marvel and Marvel Studios. I will never forgive what, I mean, don't get me wrong, like the Miss Marvel series, it was overall very good. Iman Vellani is amazing, as were most of the cast. And however, you know, the best part was that story were her family and friends, but not the best part were the way she got her powers and the way they changed her powers, and B, whatever that story was and whatever that story was in the Marvels, because they stripped so much from Kamala Khan in adapting her to the MCU. And whereas with her original comics, the point was, oh, she does not have the, like G. Willow Wilson said herself, the co-creator of Ms. Marvel, that Kamala does not have the quote unquote girly, sparkly powers. Instead, she morphs her body into, she embiggens, she can change her density. She literally is a brown girl who's increasingly proud in her own skin. Her own skin is her power. And then Marvel Studios and Kevin Feige were like, nah, we're going to give her light-based powers to, like, you know, make her match with Captain Marvel. When, again, that is completely outside of the point of who she's supposed to be.
It also ignores her origin story in the comics.
Exactly.
Where she only took Ms. Marvel because it was what she could think of. Mm-hmm. You know, not that she didn't look up to Carol, but, like, it was kind of just like, oh, that's a name that I know. That's a disguise I can adopt right now.
Exactly.
So yeah, that is an interesting one. And I think
and also so much else in Marvel Studios generally, if we're being honest.
Yeah. I mean, I think anytime that you get something where they hit a formula and then decide they're going to keep hitting that formula, until it stops existing, like that's always going to be an issue. And not just for Marvel, but I mean the superhero franchise as a whole, I think DC took a couple interesting swings that paid off to varying degrees and didn't pay off. But yeah, you do get this weirdness of like, oh, you're just, you know, doing the sky beam to save the world at the, like there's no low stakes anymore for these movies. And, and that's again, going to like that worked and that had mass appeal. So why not do more of it?
Exactly. And a lot of these studios, and I think again, specifically Marvel Studios, I at this point, I really don't care if Marvel gets like one of my favorite directors. At this point, I'm hoping they don't get my favorite directors. Like I love Nita Manzur, writer, director, extraordinaire of Polite Society and We Are Lady Parts, as I mentioned before. I don't want her vision to get butchered by Marvel Studios. That's genuinely what I think happens at this point. I think that because of capitalism, because these execs just want the lowest common denominator possible, they immediately flatline everyone's visions that they hire. And it's not a true independent project. It's just not. And yeah, it's
well, and I think part of the thing with that too is the push is for, we want to follow the formula that brings us the most success. Like, and you know, and they see that by ticket sales, which we're, you know, phrasing as like lowest common denominator, because that is how you get the most ticket sales, rather than making something truly good where people are, you're still hitting those ticket numbers, but it's because people are seeing your movie 3, 4, 5 times in theaters
because they want something
new.
That's
a totally different kind of way of hitting those numbers. And I think it's also just kind of worth looking at that angle too, of there's nothing wrong with following a formula and making something good. We have all like baked something off of a recipe we found online. However, when that's all that's being offered, and with Marvel, it's easy because it's like it's a whole franchise and kind of to a bigger extent, a whole company that's doing it. Like Disney is also in a rut with what they've been making.
Yep.
But it's when everything that's coming out is kind of the same thing. Like that's why these little one-off things that get people's attention that are not like anything else out there do. I think it's part of why they do so well. And part of why, again, if you pull the money part out and we start getting more weird stuff, I think that diversity of art that we would, you know, theoretically get, and the diversity of artists of, you know, I assume that if we're removing capitalism from this, it also means that people are just kind of free to make the art they want to make.
Yeah.
Which means more artists, which
exactly.
Would be cool. And at this point, you know, we are in pure fiction, daydream, utopia, but I do think bringing more artists out gives more diversity of art, and that diversity of art also leads to kind of more breakthroughs, you know, people trying things in ways that haven't been done before. And you see that in everything where an artist will develop a new technique and then people are like, well, I want to figure out what that, I mean, you see that in sports where like somebody cracks a new way to do the long jump and suddenly everyone is doing it because it works. And so I think we would get more options, more variety, and more iterations on that variety, and people kind of taking things to new and interesting spaces, which I want to be clear, I don't mean to bag on the current media landscape. I think there is a lot of really good and interesting stuff out there right now. I just think that there's, when you look at big companies and the companies that are most complicit in capitalism with this, what you see is them trying to just find a formula and stick with it until it sinks.
Yeah. And the reason they do that is because you have these greedy executives on the top who just care about their bottom line and don't actually care about the art. You literally have these executives right now trying to push AI because they literally want to replace human workers, even though AI, generative AI, cannot make anything anywhere nearly as good as actual humans. I personally argue that generative AI can never truly be art. It can be a supplemental tool for artists, absolutely, for writers, for animators, for artists in general, but no, it's literally just being shoved down our throats. You know, even us recording on Zoom right now, I see, here, you want to use a Zoom AI assistant? I'm thinking, no fucking thank you, because I do not need AI to literally just push a button. You know, that's where we're at.
The whole issue too, with, to do a brief tangent on AI with art, like, part of the issue is that it's never been about the end product. Mm-hmm. It is purely about the expediency.
Yes.
And the only reason to produce more art faster is to produce more profit faster.
Yeah.
It is, you know, I mean, and that's, we still haven't done an AI specific episode, but that is its own episode. But yeah, I think you have something there of like, yeah, this could be something that you might find a way to leverage. Like, I personally am just deeply against AI and will never use it, but I understand that there are people who are going to leverage it and you can't stop that. Yeah. Actually, interestingly, so I've talked about it on the show a few times. I have a Playdate console, that little yellow box with the crank, and on their store, there is a tag that tells you this game was made without use of generative AI.
Oh, nice.
It's like you can intention, because I did find pretty early on, because it has a very accessible software developer's kit. There were people online who were like, oh yeah, like I had ChatGPT or whatever make me all these character sprites and I think it looks pretty good. And it's like, well, gross. Like, you could have paid a pixel artist to do this instead, but here we are. And although that goes back to the capitalism of it, of like, things are like, paying people for their time and what their time is genuinely worth gets expensive.
Mm-hmm.
That's also kind of a part of this, of like, money is so inextricably tied to art and also inextricably tied to like livelihood and well-being. And I think that that's part of what complicates this whole conversation in general. Because I was trying to think through, like, is there a way that capitalism is helpful? And or actually, even before we get into that, like, why am I singling out money specific? Like, why are we singling out money specifically as a potential evil here? Because, and this is kind of rearranging how I had outlined this conversation, but art has never existed in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it is the outside world, world events, like, I mean, you drove to work and you saw a nice sunrise and now that color palette is in your head, your own beliefs as a person are going to influence the, like, art has never been in a vacuum. So why is, like, money this one influence that we're wanting to single out? And I feel like the answer is very obvious, but I did want to open it to conversation.
Well, you know, money is what we use to just have a living, to have shelter, food, entertainment, healthcare, even though I would argue for most of those, if not all of those, or in education, at least higher education, mm-hmm. for all of those, I would argue those shouldn't be some things we have to pay for. You know, I consider myself a socialist. I believe that most basic human needs should be for free. And, you know, if people want to, like, engage in a market on other goods, fine. But it's insane to me, like, really, that we have, because of greed, that's really why we have systems of money as we do today. I mean, to be clear, we've always had mm-hmm. money, but for the longest time, money has been used as a status symbol. It's been used to separate, you know, the rich from the poor, and it's meant to be a means of concentrating wealth and power, so that you know, those high on lords can take advantage of the serfs effectively. We still have effectively serfdoms, even though they look different and we're given the illusion of choice. This is, whenever I watch The Matrix, whenever they're describing The Matrix, I'm just like, that's capitalism. That's exactly capitalism, what they're describing. That's what we live under. And yeah, we have to talk about it because it's literally how we have to live our lives, and we have to, you know, like give like money as a means of power. We have to give that power over to others, often to those richer above us, and them trying to concentrate their own wealth. And
I mean, that's kind of where the problem lies, is like wealth trading hands is fine. Wealth stagnating in one very, very small subset of people, that's where there's more of an issue. And, and yeah, I think you're right. It's that like money is, it is how you get by. It's also how you make more art, unfortunately. If I make a movie for $20 million and I make $5 on it, I can't make another movie, and I probably can't get people to give me more money to make another movie.
That's, again, the great thing about public funding is that, you know, it's always going to be there, and the public is always going to enjoy your, because it's a means of equalizing this means of distribution of people consuming your work and you getting still the funds for your work. And it's just a healthy, in my opinion, like, it's obviously not always perfect as it's existed, but still it, to me, it looks like a far more sustainable way of doing things and engendering really much more goodwill between yourself and the audience. And to go on a bit of a side tangent, and the thing is, to be clear, they obviously do have to engage in capitalism, but you know who I think embodies this principle really well, even though they're not technically a publicly funded company, but did you know who I think it is?
I don't.
Dropout TV.
That's a great, that's a great example.
Like, God bless Sam Reich and everything he's built, and the streaming service, you know, like, you have to do like a monthly or annual fee, but you can tell these are very good people who care about the shows they're making. And you literally have prominent anti-capitalists, like, God bless Brendan Lee Mulligan, who is an avowed socialist and cares about so many humanitarian causes and constantly calls out capitalism as the enemy, as he should. And the thing is, like, they care about the community they've built. They care about the audience they've built. And I remember watching, you know, like, just to keep up with inflation and whatnot, Sam announcing that they're doing a $1 price increase. Yes. And literally people were saying, okay, can I give you more? Because I just love what you do so much.
Yeah, definitely. And it's one of those shows where, or it's one of those services where you watch it and you truly get the impression and believe that they are not answering to anyone.
Exactly.
They are making the shows that they want to make. And I
think they want people to enjoy as much as possible. And they're like, especially, again, I mean, all of them, but Brennan's like one of my favorites. And he, I would imagine him being at his happiest. I've watched a couple of interviews with him. Him being at his happiest, where he could just be a dungeon master. That his job is a professional storyteller. And he would be happy, you know, working for something like PBS, working for a publicly funded company, and just telling various different stories all the time. And you can tell, like, he, Sam, the others, like, do, there's so many of them, so I'm not going to name all of them, but, like, they do it for the love of the craft. They do it for the love of stories. Yes. They do it for the love of improv. They do it for the love of Dungeons and Dragons. They do it for just the pure love of art. So in that, in a way, it feels like an adult PBS. You know what I mean?
I can see that. And I think, I mean, the interesting thing with that too is just that this is, it's an interesting example because it very much started under capitalism as College Humor being owned by, I think, like a hedge fund or something.
Right.
And what turned them into this was Sam just buying it, just saying, like, if you want to shut it down, how about instead you sell it to me?
Yeah.
And now they're in this really cool spot, but he also needed that money to be able to do that. Like, he needed that capital.
Of course.
So what that kind of brings me to is there a way that capitalism ever actually helps art? Because it's very easy to point out the negatives, I think. But the things that came to mind first is, like, reach more than anything. I mean, Dropout spreads by word of mouth. Independent movies spread by word of mouth. But like having like a delivery mechanism, you know, delivery method, a distribution mechanism, a marketing department, like that's all stuff that's a little bit harder to come by without capitalism behind it. Cause like, why would I want to pay to help you get the word out on something? And the answer is you do it out of the goodness of your heart, but that's not the world that we live in.
Yeah. The marketing is in of itself like a competition between these companies to be like, hey, come see my movie. No, come see my movie, or come to my park. Or no, come to my park. You know, it's literally the reason why Universal and Disney are right next to each other, so that like customers will go to both of them.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, yeah, I think that's where it was kind of interesting. Cause I think the, like I said, it's easy to point out the negatives. Like as soon as money is involved, there's a question of how compromised the work is, so to speak. I think propaganda is way easier when it's, you know, when money is involved. Like the we've talked about this on the show, the US military will give you access to actual military equipment if they get a say in how they're portrayed,
like in Marvel Studios.
Yes. And like that's kind of a big deal. And then, you know, just, I mean, straight up like government propaganda, like if the government pays for a movie to get made, it's just like an immediate thing. There's also studio interference. We talked about that. Was it the Fantastic Four, the one with the really bad logo where the A was a four, where the, after it came out, the director tweeted like, that wasn't my cut. And I don't know that a good cut of that movie exists,
right?
But the fact that there was so much interference that he felt the need to voice that. Or maybe that was Suicide Squad.
I think it was Fantastic Four.
It was? Okay.
I think so.
The other really big example of that for me is, have you watched the old three-season sitcom Happy Endings?
I have not. What's that one about again?
So the very first episode of Happy Endings is a woman leaving her fiance at the altar.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest of the series is that group of friends, including the fiance, the two people who were going to be married, trying to stay together as a group of friends. And it's like, it's, you know, it's a comedy, but early on it's a little bit heavier because they're dealing more with the emotional fallout of being left at the altar.
Mm-hmm.
And ABC was like, no one's going to watch this. It's too much of a bummer. So let's just air it out of order. And when you do that, it actually just doesn't make sense anymore.
Oh my
like
God.
One episode they're on good terms, next episode they're not talking. Like it's just
that's
very
so manipulative.
Yeah. And it was purely because they were like, we got to pump those numbers. We got to get people watching. And of course they're not going to follow the story arc week to week. And yeah, I think like it took a while to even for streaming platforms to correct the streaming order. Like for a minute there, you had to go on Wikipedia, look up the production codes and then watch it in that order. And then, you know, just like focus groups, which again, we talked about Marvel. We talked about like just all of this coming in of like, how do we maximize appeal and profit, and kind of strip away the things that make it interesting. It's the best example I can think to compare it to is if you remember in the 90s when like furniture had color and texture, and then IKEA introduced rectangles. And that's kind of what a lot of that overly focused studied media feels like to me. Where it's like, you're right, you made a very efficient table. The things that make tables interesting are not here to me. And it's just kind of a weird thing to watch. Or the other example that I had was like, do you remember what iBooks looked like in the 90s?
I think so.
Where they were like, it was a clamshell version of those big like candy colored iMacs.
Oh yeah.
And
yeah,
now
yeah.
Apple is like, here's our new silver rectangle. And I'm like, you're stripping out anything that made this cool. Like it's, and you know, maybe this is just that I'm a campy person.
But I know exactly what you're talking about. Like the clear colored plastic that we'd have on so many electronics, like on Nintendo specifically, like what happened to those controllers? Why don't we get those kinds of Joy-Cons where you can see the interior of it?
Yeah. And so like we used to do all these cool things with design, and I feel like these like overly processed, overly refined movies kind of miss that. Like it's, you know, when was the last time that you watched a movie and you were like, oh, that person has normal teeth? Like every single aspect of it is fine tuned to be like as appealing as possible.
Right.
To the point that when an actor or actress does have normal teeth, you notice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's wild to me. So yeah, I think all that to say though, like this is kind of why we have to be extra critical of money, because it does, it does not necessarily day one, this is ruined and will never be what it was meant to be, but it immediately opens the door to it being compromised or corrupted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, again, it's just like, it's that flatlining. Is that flatlining we see, like you said, in the electronics that we have in so much of sheer room design of like, couch design even. And yeah, it just, it makes everything so uninteresting. And again, I keep going back to this, it's what's happened with Marvel movies a lot. It's what happened with a lot of these big franchises. I think audiences are starting to just get over it. Happened with, you know, I'm thinking about Disney, a lot of like, this will refer back to Disney, even though they're not the main culprit, but actually they feel like the main culprit.
They're kind of a big culprit here, yeah.
Yeah. No, but it happened like, you know, with their live actions and Snow White bombing, that literally, thank God, alhamdulillah, they have stopped production on the Tangled live action, and there are rumors even they stopped live action adaptations of their animated films, which thank God, because there's only been like one or two good ones in a sea of terrible ones overall. Mm-hmm. Because again, I think that eventually there's diminishing returns, right? I think that audiences are just not interested in this same slop anymore, so much so that they're not even willing to take their kids to it as they usually do, because guess what, there's a lot of great kids media out there, you know. Mm-hmm. At Home and other movies out there, but also with Snow White, I forgot who said it, but I don't think like audiences are really interested in watching an adaptation of a 100-year-old film on like, and again, like you know, there were people specifically boycotting it because of the hardline, you know, supporter of Zionism and the genocide in Gaza. Mm-hmm. You know, Gal Gadot, like specifically boycotting for that. I don't think, I barely saw anyone saying they were boycotting it specifically about Rachel Zegler. In fact, in those like the attempted hit piece on Rachel Zegler that both Disney and Gal Gadot were effectively behind, as we can assume at least, her popularity shot up because they're like, oh, she's badass. She like refused this big Hollywood producer and kept her message up online and her activism. Mm-hmm. That's what audiences, I think, want to see more of. It's not just me being like optimistic or because it's my own. It's what I've actually observed online at the very least. And again, people just don't want to see these regurgitations because they're increasingly realizing, hey, these are terrible. And I think they will realize the same with the How to Train Your Dragon movies, which also look like the live action ones, which also look terrible. And I can't believe they already greenlit How to Train Your Dragon 2. All right, good luck, Universal. Yeah, they did. I'm just like, we're confident enough that this is going to do well. All right, good luck to you, Universal. Like this, yeah. I already hate this movie so much.
No, I agree. And I mean, yeah, because I think kind of where we're at is like, obviously capitalism is not going anywhere. We're not going to get rid of it overnight. But also like, while people may not care about the funding of a film, like very few people are going to look at like who backed it, how did this get made, yada, yada, mm-hmm. yada. People are going to look at the quality of it. And I think that that's kind of where capitalism shows its ass, is that you can kind of tell when something has been overly engineered to maximize profit. And that is, I think, at least in the conversations I've had with people, it's increasingly a turnoff. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are times where I'll see something and I'm like, this is absolutely playing on like every possible thing it could to make me want it, and it's succeeding. And then there's times where it's like, oh, this thinks it's doing that, and it's not, because I'm so aware that it's doing that, and it's doing it in such a played out, predictable way.
Yeah.
Like if we're trying to divorce money from art, it's, you know, I don't see it happening in our lifetime, at least on a large scale. But I think the thing that's going to help is people getting a little bit savvier, getting a little bit keener when they start noticing those things of like, I mean, how many movies did it take before we caught on that Chris Pratt was being shoved in everything?
I mean, he's still being shoved in everything. I mean, he is.
But we're aware now and it doesn't work anymore.
Well, I mean, listen, and I say this as someone who doesn't like him much as a person, he's still a good actor. I thought he was really good in Guardians 3. So
So that's the thing, is I feel like he's a guy who he's a you know, good performer in the right projects. Mm-hmm. Guardians 3, absolutely. Mario, I liked that movie. Yeah. I still don't think he was a good fit for it.
Yeah, he wasn't.
Like, for that. Yeah. It's, you know, it's the same way that, like, you know, if you are a person who cooks with spices, which should be all of you listening, you have to know how to use the spice and how much of it to use and what they do when they're together. Like, you can't just say, like, oh, you liked that one thing that I put, I don't know, fennel seed in, I'm putting it in everything, because fennel seed doesn't work everywhere. Like, I love it, but it doesn't work everywhere, and you can't just throw it into things.
So you're saying I shouldn't put it in my oatmeal tomorrow morning?
You know, I've never tried it, but I do think it would be bad. I feel like you'd be better off with cinnamon.
Yes, with cinnamon, nutmeg, and cardamom. That's what I usually like to do.
Ooh, yeah, that's a good mix.
Cardamom's so good. It's my favorite spice.
And in this instance, cinnamon is Chris Pratt.
It's like, in terms of, like, yeah, you're right. Like, you try to. Okay. And here's the thing. I genuinely really like Zendaya. I do think she's a very talented performer. I enjoyed her in, for example, Challengers. I think she's good in the Spider-Man films. You know, like, I also. The thing is, like, she can be a good voice actor. I was also wondering, oh, like, she's going to be the daughter of Shrek and Fiona in Shrek 5. Okay, I guess. But I think it is, like, here's the thing. We can acknowledge that they're talented people, but also maybe the reason, you know, executives are choosing them first and foremost is because they have that name recognition. When I would argue, hey, Shrek in and of itself is already, it's already great name recognition there. And you had in Puss in Boots: The Last Wish, both famous actors who are also talented and very well suited for their roles, making Puss in Boots: The Last Wish maybe the best film in the entire, like, Shrek franchise. And, like, along with its great storytelling. So I don't see, you know, why, I don't know. Maybe she'll give a great vocal performance, but it does seem a little off for Zendaya.
Yes.
I know. And again, I love Zendaya. I'm just like.
Yeah, I also have that gut reaction of, like, stop casting actors as voice actors, because a lot of the times they're not right.
Well, they can be great voice actors. I want to, like,
they can
that.
Be. Yeah. I just, my general impulse when someone's like, hey, this guy that you've never seen do voice acting, he's our, you know, whatever. I was going to say Shrek, that was, like, the one franchise where I'm like, it's kind of always been that, like, it, you know, it's Mike Myers and Cameron Diaz and Eddie Murphy and John Lithgow. And it is just kind of a lot of actors doing it. So I'm like, that's the one where you maybe get away with it. But I agree you know, trying to leverage a name to draw people in. It's not a particularly inspired choice. It is a money inspired choice.
Right.
So I think that's the other thing, is that we might get, you know, more interesting casting. And again, people with normal teeth. Like, go watch an old movie. People looked so different.
Yeah. I do think, public funding of TV and film allows for that. It allows for example, in We Are Lady Parts, for actors that, I think the only one I had seen in other things really was Anjana Vasan, who plays the main character, along with, I'm forgetting her name, but, like, Noor, she plays Anjana Vasan's, like, best friend in the series. You know, they, like, other than that, like, We Are Lady Parts had, like, so many actors I hadn't seen before, and that was great. It gave me, like, new faces and let me follow them in their own independent work, their own, like, work on stage and their own, like, music that they produce and create, and it's really great. Yeah, I think public funding just allows for, I guess, like, if we're getting a wider discussion about the role of the artist and, like, sort of that celebrity factor, capitalism may generally, and I know there are differing opinions on this, but it does breed more of that cult of celebrity, again, as a commodity for audiences to gravitate towards that executives can use. Whereas in public funding of art, the director, the casting directors, they can literally just choose whomever they want genuinely fits most for the role, because they don't have that added pressure of, oh, I need to get a big name that someone will love. Mm-hmm. And I believe, and obviously this isn't my lane, but in the casting for Children of Blood and Bone, which is a Nigerian-inspired series written by Tomi Adeyemi, I observed many in the Black community and Nigerian communities criticize the casting because, you know, while for the most part, you know, they look like the roles they look like, except unfortunately, Amandla Stenberg, again, she's a relatively light-skinned Black woman, cast in a role for a darker-skinned Black woman. You know, it's like I admire her deeply for pro-Palestine and other advocacy, but can't defend her on this. Like, Amandla, come on. Like, but again, I'm not in that community, so I can't like fully speak to that. Yeah. And I just observed that, like, yeah, they chose big names or actors who had been like other big movies to like play some of these roles. And yes, there are like Nigerians and like people of Nigerian descent, like in the film, like in the main cast. But I think like for the main trio, like there was criticism of that casting. And perhaps like if this wasn't in as a capitalist driven setting, then hey, they could just cast Nigerians straight up or like people of Nigerian descent. Yeah. So yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it's just, it's a whole thing to watch for. And it, and I think the other thing that I struggle with in all of this is that I know that the average person is not this critical of media and production and all that. Mm-hmm. So it's also where it's like, not like, oh, I feel like I'm shouting into a void, but it is like, well, how do you correct course on this when people are not necessarily going to dive into it? And like, I think supporting indie art is a big part of it. I think getting those movies seen, getting weird stuff seen, you know, pushing for the Oscar nominations. We talk every year about how the Oscars mean nothing, but we also know that they still inform public opinion a little bit. So, you know, there is something to it. And I think for me, it's just, you know, keeping a more watchful eye for when people are passionate about what they're working on, whether it's like an indie video game where it's like one dude. I mean, I like Blue Prince, which I've talked about three weeks in a row, was like a guy who just had an idea for a game and spent, I think, like 6 years making it. It, you know, and that was purely just like a thing he was doing on his own. Stardew Valley is another example of that, of a guy who just was like, oh, I really like this game style, but I don't like the direction it has gone as a whole genre. Let me just pour myself into a game and see if it clicks with people. And we got an incredible game that's coming up on its like 10-year anniversary next year, that's still getting content updates because he's not done with it and he loves what he's doing. So yeah, I mean, that's kind of my like big final push is like, if you guys like what we're talking about of people making the weird art they want to make and making cool art that may not be for you, but is for somebody, like pursue indie art, games, music, movies, like whatever. But that's like, those are the people who like, they're there to do it, not to make money. Not again, not that money's not nice to have. We talked about how it's how you live and make more art, but like, I don't know. The intention just feels a little different when it's not about that maximized wealth extraction. So yeah, support indie art is where I'm at on this. What about you? Any closing thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. Same. Support indie art, support indie artists, support not the big companies. I mean, like support like the individual artists who are creating art and film and TV in those big companies. For example, Ryan Coogler, you should all watch Sinners if you haven't yet. Support independent creators like my favorite creator right now, Nita Manzoor. By the way, speaking of her, the name I was looking for earlier is Aisha Hart, who plays Noor. Again, amazing actor, along with the various other actors whom I hadn't heard of before, like in We Are Lady Parts when it came out in 2021. I'm hoping it gets a third season, please, fingers crossed. And yeah, like support that. Support like the art you genuinely believe in, from marginalized artists, from artists tackling subjects that would be considered maybe taboo by these big companies that, again, care about the bottom line and care about making a lowest common denominator of art, of quote unquote art, that really just becomes regurgitated slop that they think that audiences are just going to eat up all the time. But I really do think, like, here's the thing. I think that we're in a period of major flux and change in our society. And I think that also extends to film and TV. I think audiences are desperate for media that's hopeful, media that's really going to be about challenging systems, because they realize, hey, these systems are not working for us. And it is, yeah, it's reflected in the art we consume. And yeah, just support art and artists you believe in. And hopefully one day we can get to a point where we have public funding, like up the wazoo, that will just help artists just be artists, because it is a public good. It is something that's good for the benefit and health of society. Like, since time immemorial, you know, there have been patrons for artists. There's been public funding for art, because like from the pharaohs of Egypt up until today, like, as long as you don't have, you know, someone, we have had throughout history and we have now, people in power trying to contort public funding of the arts for their own means, which is terrible, which is kind of like its whole other subject, you know, like maybe we should discuss more on. But still, by and large, with like a public trust and understanding, public funding for the arts is such a good, wonderful thing that we all should be encouraging responsible public funding of the arts and upholding the arts. And it is a possibility. We can break out of our capitalist chains.
Yes, absolutely. Well said. And I think that does it for this week. But if you listening at home want more, we do have it. But Why Though is on Blue Sky. You can find us at butwhytho.net. You can also subscribe to our newsletter or donate to the podcast by going to butwhytho.net/support. Everything you give goes towards keeping the site running, keeping the lights on, paying our writers, all that good stuff. So we really appreciate anything that you can give. Swara, thank you so much for joining me. I had a great time with this conversation. And I hope you did as well. And
I thank you all for listening. Thank you.
Awesome. Yeah. We'll see you guys next time.
Take care, y'all.